Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. Using BetterHelp online therapy can help life feel easier, and you deserve to focus on your well-being. One member told us, "My therapist has been absolutely incredible at helping me through trauma I never knew I had." Visit betterhelp.com/JuneGermany today to get free therapy before the 22nd of June. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/JuneGermany. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before, and not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the BBC World Service, this is The Documentary, the home of original storytelling. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and I'm here to tell you about our podcast, What in the World, which helps you make sense of what's happening in your world. This is a bonus episode, and we're looking at female genital mutilation in Africa and when it will be brought to an end. But before we start, some of what you're about to hear may be upsetting because some of the descriptions are quite graphic.
Every cut was absolutely an immediate whoosh of fire.
That's Hibo. She went through FGM when she was just 6 years old, and she's one of more than 230 million girls and women worldwide who've had it done to them.
It's a huge problem in the world. 3 million women and girls are at risk every year of FGM. We are seeing it as a human rights abuse that has to be addressed by everyone.
The Gambia made FGM a crime punishable by up to 3 years in prison back in 2015. Less than 10 years later, Parliament is taking steps to overturn that ban.
Campaigners fear that a lack in adequate data collection is masking a much larger problem.
The World Health Organization describes FGM as a human rights violation, and it says it has no health benefits. It wants to end the practice around the world by 2030. And this practice is most common in Africa. 28 countries there have passed laws against it, but controversially, the Gambia is now trying to make it legal again. First of all, let's get some of the facts. I've been speaking to Esther Ogola in Kenya. She's a BBC reporter who covers women's affairs in Africa. Hi, Esther.
Hi, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So what exactly is FGM and where does it happen?
So FGM, or female genital mutilation, it refers to all the procedures that involve the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia and other injuries to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. So it's usually performed by older women, traditional cutters in the community, and they use crude tools sometimes, such as razor blades, knives, or pieces of glass. They do not offer any anesthesia, so victims and survivors endure a lot of pain, and in some cases, the victims also die. Africa has the largest burden, and then followed by Asia and then the Middle East. The number of cases in Africa vary country to country. However, Somalia has almost universal prevalence rate at 99%.
FGM was made illegal in the Gambia in 2015, and now they're talking about repealing that ban, essentially making it legal again. Why would they want to repeal that ban?
The push behind repealing the ban is mainly religious and cultural. The Muslim clerics in Gambia say that this is actually supported in Islam. They also say that it's a cultural practice and that in essence, the religious and cultural freedoms of the people of Gambia precedes what we call women's rights violations. But to them, it's an infringement of their cultural and religious freedoms.
Tell us a bit more about this bill. How likely do you think it is? And what do people think about it there?
Well, as you know, the MPs debated and overwhelmingly voted to have the bill move forward. So it is now in the committee stage where it is being scrutinised. The relevant parliamentary committee will then bring a report back to Parliament, and then Parliament will debate the report. 42 MPs voted for the bill, while only 4 voted against. In terms of the public feeling and opinion, it's pretty divided. There are those who still strongly support it from a cultural and a religious point of view, including women. And right now they seem to carry the day in terms of how the debate has played out. But civil society and survivors who have fought long and hard to have FGM criminalized say they haven't given up hope yet.
The UN is trying to end FGM by 2030. Do you think that's likely?
I don't think that's likely. I'll give an example. For Kenya, we had said we hope to end it by 2022, but it hasn't happened because it's a deeply held belief. And so there are some communities that are still very resistant to change. And what they do is that they've also managed to adapt with the intervention structures put in place. So you'll find, for instance, if girls were being cut at 15 years, you find they change the age. They now start cutting at 9 years. Sometimes they take them to border communities where it is not illegal, or they share the same beliefs. The number of girls who've been cut in the last couple of years has increased by 30 million. And it's attributed to things such as COVID-19, where, you know, movement intervention stopped. For instance, schools used to be a very huge intervention space for girls. They could run to school and get a place to stay and food. But during COVID-19 and lockdowns, you know, that was not available anymore. So this has sort of rolled back some of the gains made. And now people have to work double time in order to try and end this practice.
This can be a painful subject for survivors to speak out about, but their testimonies are helping to change how the practice is seen. And at the beginning of this episode, you heard from Hiba Wardere. She's from Somalia, and she survived FGM and now works as an activist. So let's hear a bit more from her now. I imagine this is a topic that comes with guilt and shame and stigma that people maybe aren't used to talking about and hearing about.
Yes, it is the most, especially the communities we come from, we don't talk about female genitalia at all or female bodies at all. So we grew up very much an embarrassment attached to our bodies. Now something happened to your genital, that's even worse. Mm. You can't talk about it.
Why do some cultures perform FGM?
Well, they have all their own reasons on why this is done. Some would say it's to do with identity. Some they say it's to do with you becoming a woman. And the danger attached to that is if a girl's 13 or 12 and they cut her, they deem her to be a woman. That means she's ready for marriage, childbirth, all those things. But the whole thing, the whole root of it is about controlling women and girls' sexuality.
As a woman, I found it quite difficult to hear the things that people do to women's bodies.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this because you have direct experience. You are a survivor of it yourself.
Yeah. So I had a type called type 3, which is the total removal of the clitoris and the labias, and then whatever skin is left, they sew it up and leave you a tiny hole. And I was only 6 years old. And I got absolutely bullied in school because when I was in the school, I was asked by the girls, are you cut? And I'm thinking, no. And I went back home one day and I cried to my mom's lap. I said, look, I don't know what cutting is. I don't want to go back to school. I'm being bullied. Whatever that is, do it. And my mom was like, okay. A few weeks later, there's a massive party. Everybody's coming. I'm giving all sorts of presents. I'm told, you know, you're going to be brave. You're going to be beautiful woman. You're going to be this and that. I don't have no clue, but I'm loving. But I never, ever, ever realized what comes next would literally strip everything that I've known in my life. You know, your people that you trust and love are holding you down. Every cut was absolutely an immediate whoosh of fire. And that day, you just realize how much you have lost everybody around you. I lived in a very, very heightened emotion every time I saw my auntie, my mom, and everybody huddled up in a corner. I'm thinking, what's coming next? Am I going to die next?
On a physical level, how did it affect your ability to live your day-to-day life, to go to the toilet when you had your periods?
Horrible.
You had many children.
It is horrible. Urinating was difficult. Simple thing that humans are doing. For us, girls like me, was a challenging. And then you hit puberty and you get period. That was even worse. Your abdominal area is on fire. For me, I lived with that until I got to UK when I was 18 as an asylum seeker. And that is when I got help.
So was it a type of reconstructive surgery that you
had? Yes. So they call it deinfibulation. So what they're going to do, you have a tiny vagina hole. What they're going to do is open that and tuck the edges, but they can't reconstruct your labias. They can't reconstruct your clitoris.
So you had the surgery, you sought help, you got help. How did that surgery affect you mentally? How did it change your confidence, the way you saw the world?
Oh my goodness, it did. And it kind of also affected in a negative way. A negative way for me, it was like, who's going to marry me was the biggest part. But also to know after a few weeks of adjusting myself mentally and, you know, emotionally, and knowing that my physicality has changed again, and this time is a good thing, was also a massive thing.
What would you say to people who still believe that girls should be cut?
Those women, I actually want them to sit down and think about themselves. You have normalized your own pain. And we all know deep down, every woman knows what was done to her is wrong. Why do you want that for your daughter? This is our bodies. Our genitals are special. They are functional. They belong to us. It doesn't belong to a man, but we still have a long way to go.
When you hear those stories, you can really see how much FGM affects girls and women. And that's one of the reasons that some countries are trying to reduce rates. Kenya, for example, has more than halved the number of girls who are subjected to it. Here's Esther again.
FGM was really in our faces. And when I say in our faces, is that people really talked about what FGM is, what it does. And survivors had a chance to share their experiences. And so people were able to internalize what FGM really is. And then have those discussions about should we end it or should we not? And then organizations and activists actively engaging communities. For instance, there's a really concerted effort to engage men and boys as allies. Still, in African communities, men have a bigger, more authoritative say. So if they buy into ending FGM, then it's easy to actually sort of integrated in the community. Also, we had alternative forms of programs. So in some communities, FGM is considered a rite of passage. You only become a woman after you've undergone FGM. Before that, you're just a girl, you're just a child. You have no say, and people determine your life for you. And so what they did is that they introduced alternative rites of passage. So there's a program they undergo when they're 15 where they learn life skills. The only difference is you get a different skill and a different graduation into womanhood and not FGM.
You have been reporting on this for quite a while. It sounds like there have been some very innovative approaches. Overall, do you think the tide is turning on FGM?
I think it is a little bit slower than what activists and survivors would want because of unforeseen things like the COVID-19 pandemic. I know even the UN is saying people now have to work 2 times harder, 10 times harder. The thing is not to drop the guard, be active in this space, and that will help to push the end of FGM.
Esther, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's hear about Hebo's hopes for the future.
The way that we're going right now, the way the whole world is starting to notice, we are going to see the end of it. I wholeheartedly believe in that.
This is such a personal issue, and I am so grateful to Hebo for joining me to tell her story. So while most countries probably won't meet the UN goal of ending FGM by 2030, there may be a future soon where women and girls won't have to go through what she endured. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the documentary. If you'd like to hear more episodes from our podcast, you can search for BBC What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Suzanne Wilton, and for more than 2 decades, I've been searching for the truth behind the world's largest gold hoax.
We were sitting on one of the largest gold deposits that the world had ever found.
A mother lode across the world in Indonesia.
A billion-dollar con on a scale never seen before or since.
It looks like they've invented the deposit.
This is a scam.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
People were willing to roll the dice at any cost.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.